At Red Barn, our pet food ingredients work overtime. They aren't just there for show. Dandelion greens work to maintain a healthy digestive system. Salmon oil works to enhance the immune system. Green-lipped mussels work to support joint health. These hard-working ingredients support your dog's active, healthy life. Look at the label. We want you to. Red Barn Naturals Pet Food. Simply the best. Find it in your local pet specialty store. Try our grain-free stews. The only pet food with Red Barn Bully Sticks.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Food Awakenings, where we explore the greatest medical miracle of our lifetime, real food. Each week, we explore the mysteries and magic within food and the implications for healing human and planet through the growing movements in living food, wild foods, and superfoods. With you is your host, Dr. Ariel Policano, naturopathic physician, researcher, and author. Welcome to Food Awakenings, where we explore the greatest medical miracle of our lifetime, real food. Each week, we explore the mysteries and magic within food and the implications for healing human and planet through the growing movements in living food, wild foods, and superfoods. With you is your host, Dr. Ariel Policano, naturopathic physician, researcher, and author, with weekly guests, the latest in food research, and your phone calls. And now your host, Dr. Ariel Policano.
John, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, my goodness. I hope you've all hung in there and listened. Oh, thank goodness. Okay. Well, I think
just to let you know, I've been hearing nothing up until now.
Okay. Well, let's hope for the best. And if you're listening, you may not have heard the introduction, so I want to re-welcome you. And I want to say hi to everybody. This is Food Awakenings. This is a show about live food, wild foods, and superfoods. And we're going to get right into it. Did you hear your introduction?
No. And matter of fact, I was listening on the computer, too, just to see if, you know, and it just came on like a couple of seconds after we started talking. So.
Okay. It just came on now then.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the wonders of radio and, who knows, the goddess of phone calling and all of that. So this is going to be on the archives, and some of you probably hung in there and are listening live. So what I want to do is I want to welcome everybody to Food Awakenings, and we're going to get right into it. This is a show about wild foods, live foods, and superfoods, and today we have one of the pioneers in live foods with us, and that is Dr. John Kalis, and I want to tell you a little bit about him. John is a true pioneer of the wild food world. He holds a doctorate in nutrition, a master's degree in education, degrees in biology and zoology. He is a botanist, a nature photographer, a writer, a researcher, and a teacher. John has researched edible wild plants since 1970 and taught in colleges, universities, and to the general public since 1978. He has taught and trained thousands of people about wild foods all over North America and given many informative wild food presentations to a variety of groups. I know that he's also taught at Michigan State University and Portland State University. So I'm so excited to welcome you, John. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, goodness. Okay, so nice to hear your voice. So,
well, we still may not be on the air, but we'll find out soon.
Okay, excellent. So for those of you who are listening, and hopefully we are all on air together, I wanted to let you know that the guest call-in number is 914-338-0821, 914-338-0821. And I was saying, not too many people heard me, that we are actually giving away a calendar to the first person who calls in today with a question for John. And that is a calendar from Turtle Lake Refuge. It's a gift from Katrina Blair, and it's a beautiful moon calendar with many recipes in the wild food world. So, John, again...
Yep.
Welcome, and tell me a little bit about what sparked your interest in the wild food world.
Well, originally, when I was a kid, I was interested in wilderness survival and self-reliance, and I don't know what psychological things brought me to that, but when I was growing up, I was trying to sort of emulate Native Americans. You know, I'd go in the woods and try and make a bow and arrow and, you know, make primitive huts and try and make fire by rubbing two sticks together, that kind of thing. And that interest lasted for a long time, but it started to evolve into an interest in wild foods, which is part of that. Because if you think about it, early cultures, you know, before agriculture, made their living off of wild foods. That's what they did. That was their job all day long. They were out hunting and gathering. And so that area became much more interesting to me. And then as I was in college and decided to go traveling through Europe, I didn't have any money and thought, well, geez, wouldn't it be great if I could save some money by getting all my vegetables from wild plants?
Really? Wow.
So I did a whole bunch of research before I went over, and then, you know, I would get my the other parts of the diet, the bread, the milk, the meat, and things like that from the stores. But by the end of the trip, I was getting all my vegetables, which was my goal, from wild foods, and it did save me a lot of money. It was amazing, and that just, you know, from there I came back and the people at the university said, hey, you're the expert now, and you've done all this stuff, and why don't you teach, you know, a class in wild foods? So I did that at Michigan State for a bunch of years, and then decided, hey, I'm going to make this a career. It's so much fun. And so I moved here to Portland, Oregon, and this is my full-time job. I've been doing it for, you know, over a decade now.
That's amazing. It's exciting. I mean, it matches my excitement that I've had in the living food world and that meeting Ann Wigmore and connecting with Ann Wigmore and wanting to do more. And the more that I did, the more it kind of became for me. And it sounds like it's been the same for you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it combines so many interests. You know, I'm a curious person and love to investigate things and love to solve problems and things like that. And since, you know, our modern world has so moved away from the earth into indoors and computers and business and technology and all that kind of stuff, you know, there's sort of a vacuum out there, and a lot of the information has been lost. So a lot of my job is rediscovering how things were done with wild foods, because you can't find it in the literature. You know, I may say, well, this is edible, but it doesn't say how it's edible or what you have to do, and if it has certain properties that, you know, affect how you cook it or whatever. You know, all those things have to be either rediscovered in, you know, like ancient literature or through experiments.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So you've actually taken the path yourself, kind of blazed the trail to develop some of that research.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's only a couple of people in North America that are really doing this kind of a thing. Most people who teach about wild foods don't know very much. All they're doing is, you know, they've got a few books that don't tell you very much, and they just repeat what the books say. And the books are so slim on information, it's amazing. One of my favorite writers on wild foods, whose name was Yul Gibbons, who wrote in the early 60s to the early 70s of the last century, you know, he would write a whole chapter on one plant and tell about his discoveries and working with it and stuff like that. Well, most of the books you find today, they'll just have a couple of sentences on edibility. You know, they'll just say, oh, yeah, the leaves are edible. But they don't tell you that, you know, no normal human could stomach eating those, you know, leaves a certain way. You've got to do something with them in order to make them edible. So, you know, the proof is, or let's see, the devil is in the details is the idiom I was looking for there.
Well, I love that. And Yul Gibbons, what in the world did he write about with such a long chapter, you know, about one topic? I mean, did he get into depths about the nutrition of the plant?
Well, he did some work. He actually had a friend who was a chemist at Pennsylvania State University and helped him to analyze a few plants. So, and then he also in his books, he transcribed data that was already done for the U.S. Department of Agriculture on some few wild foods and put it in one of his books. You know, most wild food researchers, like myself, for instance, we don't do nutrient analysis. You know, that's something that is beyond the scope. You know, if I was a multimillionaire and Wild Food Adventures, my company, was wealthy, you know, I might fund some research in that area, but, you know, I'm just a teaching institution at this point. And, you know, so most wild foods have not been analyzed. We really don't know what's in them.
And what would it take to do that kind of analysis? I'm assuming quite a bit of money would have to be poured into that.
Well, to do a thorough job would be quite expensive. I mean, you could do some initial stuff, which is what Gibbons did with that researcher at Penn State, but, you know, where you just do one analysis on like a plant or something that you gather. Well, plants in nature are like humans. You know, they're individuals, every individual is different. They've got a different personality, a different, you know, facial structure, you know, different personality. They're all unique individuals genetically. And when you go into the wild, all plants are unique individuals. So, you know, there might be some variation, particularly in the wild where conditions are very different, between one wild food and another of the same species. There could be some variation there. And so a good research study would say, okay, well, if we average all the different kinds of habitats you might find this in and all the different individuals, in general, what kind of nutrition can you expect to get from this plant? If you just do one individual, you might, you know, find tremendous amounts of one nutrient and nothing of another, and it might be the opposite in the next plant you study.
Amazing.
So, those are the kinds of things that we really don't know. But let me preface this all,
yes.
You know, this context about nutrition. You know, even though I've got a PhD in nutrition, I do not focus on nutrition.
No.
You know, I don't want to be a bookkeeper. I don't want to sit there and go, well, let's see, this, according to this nutrient chart, this food has 5 milligrams more of vitamin C than that food, so I'm going to eat this food. You know, that's not how I want to live my life. The key to good nutrition is diversity. And so the more diversity you can get in your diet and the more close to the earth you can eat, the better your diet's going to be. And so,
yeah.
You know, when I tell people to eat greens, you know, in the supermarkets, we basically have, you know, spinach and lettuce for most people. And if they're real adventurous, they're eating kale and collards and things like that, Swiss chard,
right.
You know. But all those plants are in just two plant families. You know, they're in the
exactly.
lettuce family, and then they're in the broccoli family. And, well, spinach is another one, too. So that's three. But, you know, in the plant world, there's like thousands of these, you know, different kinds of plants and hundreds of different kinds of plant families. And you know, people back in history used to eat from all of those as part of their regular diet. And that would give them huge amounts of diversity and give them all the nutrients and the phytonutrients that, you know, that are good for humans.
Fantastic. In particular, you know, I love this talk about the wild greens and the diversity. And I like your take on not trying to quantify everything to really, if we think about traditionally, I'm sure that indigenous peoples weren't, you know, sitting there going, well, gosh, I wonder if we're getting enough calcium today, you know?
Yeah.
They were just eating what was, you know, naturally available and eating it in season. So I really like your take on that. And you've really touched on something interesting. How would you say a weed or a wild green is different? And I am asking you a little bit about nutrition, but how would you describe it as being different or a little bit more advantageous than some of the typical fruits and vegetables that are in the American diet?
Boy, that's a tough question because while I have found that some wild foods in general are highly nutritious, I have a philosophical thing against making a great divide between what you buy in the store and what you can get in the wild, because there are certainly great foods you can get in the store. And the only reason that there are a bunch of wild foods that are more nutritious than some of the foods you have in the store is only because of the diversity. You know, in the wild, you know, since there are hundreds and hundreds of plants in the wild, thousands of plants that you can eat, the chance that you're going to find ones that are more nutritious than the 5 or 6 you buy in the store is great. So from
right.
that standpoint, you know, there are going to be ones that are more nutritious. Now, the only thing that's been shown in the literature that I have seen where wild is more beneficial than domestic, and that's only when in these big super farms where they don't adequately rejuvenate the soil after, you know, they keep pulling plants out and the plants are pulling out nutrients and they're not putting anything back. So it's mostly from bad agricultural practices. The places that have good agricultural practices, there should be no difference. You know, the greens and that are in the in agriculture should be just as good as the wild foods as a part of great diversity.
Fantastic.
But
now,
but the things that are limiting in you know from the poor farms are mostly minerals.
So
plants that are grown in poor conditions on farmland are going to be poorer in minerals. Now, the same thing could be true with wild foods. Like, for instance, in my garden.
And, John, let me interrupt you just for one second.
Sure.
Hold that thought because Mark is on the line, and I'm going to put Mark on the air and see if we can connect with him. Mark, are you there?
Oh, yes. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am also on an international talk host show. I have my mama in Blog Talk, of course. I would like do you have any email or something or I'll email you through the blog and we can set some time for hours. Actually, I have to do it 9 p.m. Pacific time. I need you right now.
Do you have a question for John Kalos about wild foods, Mark?
The food is you have to read the labels. You have to because MSC has 50 different names. And can your host tell me what are the other name of the MSCs that once then you eat more food, and that's what we are all us.
Okay, Mark, I got your question, and we're going to talk about it. Your phone line isn't too good, so I'm going to thank you for calling in. And this call, I think we didn't have a very good connection.
Yeah, I only got half of that.
I think he was asking about MSG, which isn't too much related to wild foods, but I'll just quickly say something about MSG. And then we'll get back to our topic, is that not good, basically. You want to avoid anything with MSG. And anything
well, one of the interesting
oh, go
things
ahead,
is,
please.
Yeah, that if I understand it correctly, the original source of MSG was seaweed. And a lot of seaweed
really?
Yeah, that you eat right out of the ocean have MSG in them. So, you know, while it's tremendously synthesized now because it's easy to synthesize. It is found in nature in normal foods.
So it makes so much sense. I mean, is that the sodium salty relationship there?
You know, I don't know the chemistry of it, and I haven't studied MSG. And you know, seaweeds are an area that I teach about mostly identification and use as foods. But I haven't delved into the chemistry of it enough to really speak with authority. So I don't want to like start making things up here. But But just to say that it is in seaweed and a few other foods. It's an amino acid, and for sure in great concentration, it can be a problem for some people. So I don't, you know, other than that, I don't know what I'm talking about. So
okay. Well, fair enough. Fair enough. You know, I wanted to ask you about some of the medicinal mushrooms and what ones are readily available and if you consider one to be more important than another.
Mycology is a whole nother expertise. While I know a bunch of mushrooms that I forage for my personal use, I definitely don't know enough to teach about that. That's a whole nother career.
What, when you say you forage for them yourselves, which ones are the most, what would you I know it takes, you have to be very careful about what you actually forage for in terms of mushrooms. Is there one that's easily recognizable that maybe is a favorite just gourmet-wise?
Easily recognizable is a relative term. You know, if you're trained in botany, a lot more things will be easily recognizable because you know to look for certain detail. If you're a novice, if you're just going out there, you know, like for instance, the morel mushrooms are very easy to identify.
Okay.
But there's a false morel.
Ah.
So, you know, telling the difference between those two is a detail you need to know. And a lot of people that go out looking for morels don't know about the false morel. Now, the false morel is not going to, like, kill you like ammonitis, but a certain proportion of the people that eat those get, you know, throw up, diarrhea, that kind of thing. So, but it's not going to kill them. So, you know, detail is important. And matter of fact, that's one of the reasons that, you know, I've just been working on a book and have finished it, that which will be out in about a year or so. One of the main focuses of the book is to take the place of, you know, the old teachers that used to, you know, when they used to gather these foods themselves, the kids would go out in the fields with them, and as the adults were gathering the plants, the kids would see what they were gathering. They would learn about them from, you know, seedling to different stages of growth to when they were adults. And so, you know, you would learn from your parents about plants. Well, now, since everyone's indoors playing video games, and, you know, parents are afraid to let them go run on their own, they think they're going to get raped or killed or kidnapped or, you know, who knows what. They don't let kids out anymore, and there are laws now about, you know, letting kids out of your sight. You know, when I was a kid, my parents let me out of their sight all the time.
Right.
You know, that you don't get that exposure to nature, and so you don't know very much. So what I'm trying to do in the books is I'm trying to walk people through all the life stages of the plant to recognize it in all its different forms, because it changes form as it, many plants change form as they grow. So you can recognize it at the different stages of growth and then be able to understand better than what parts you gather and when you gather them and how they should look when you gather them in order to really have a successful gathering experience.
Amazing. Tell me a little bit more about what you're covering in the book. And by the way, the call-in number here is 914-338-0821, 914-338-0821.
Okay, so in any event, I'm still not hearing anything on the web part of this, but we'll find out later if it actually broadcasted.
Okay.
Yeah, but your question was what?
A little bit more about the book.
In the book, I'm trying to accomplish several things. One is, like I said, to give you sort of the natural history of plants that I'm covering in there so that people actually really be able to identify them. Most books on wild foods will give you one photograph or one line drawing of the adult plant, and somehow you're supposed to be able to identify that plant. Well, I'll tell you from experience, I can take five pictures of five different adult plants of, let's say, wild spinach, and the personality of each of those photographs would be so different, you'd think they were different plants. So it's not
amazing.
Very easy for people to look at these pictures and then go into nature and say, okay, well, now I can identify this plant.
Exactly.
Not only that, but usually people are showing you pictures of the plant when they're mature and in flower. And most of the vegetable matter of plants is available to you way before the flowers appear. And so you need to be able to identify the plant when it's younger, when it's at its prime for, you know, eating the vegetables from it. And it can look totally different. And so that's why I'm saying, you know, I want to cover it from birth all the way to, you know, when the plant is dried and brown, basically, so that you can see its progression and have multiple photographs so you can see the different personalities and show you comparisons of what the leaves look like and how to positively identify the plant by little minute characteristics. So if you look close, you can go, oh, I see, that kind of thing. So that's one of the things that I'm doing in the book. Another thing I'm doing is I'm calling it sort of a manual and a pictorial guide.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really how to do it, not so much these are wild foods. And in the beginning of the book, the first third of the book is our chapters on perspective. You know, how do you study wild foods? How do you use resources to study wild foods? what do you do if you want to be successful when you're experimenting with wild foods? And when I say experimenting, I don't mean experimenting on unknowns. I mean experimenting on plants that are known to be edible, but working with them so you can figure out how they work for you.
Right.
You know, how are you going to put them in a dish or whatever? What tools are useful if you're gathering these plants? You know, do you just like, you know, rip out the leaves with your hands and then carry them around with you? Or, you know, I mean, one of the most useful tools that I found in my years of foraging is I bring a spray mister with me. You know, like you spray mist your
right.
ornamentals inside the house. So I carry one of those in a holster. And I carry plastic bags around with me, and then when I gather the plants, I put them in the plastic bag, and as I'm putting them in layers, I spray mist them to keep them moist, just like the supermarkets have these sprayers to keep the vegetables moist in the store.
Ah, I like it.
And then I keep the plastic bags I use are white, so they reflect light so that the plants don't cook in the bag. And I try and keep them in the shade, even so, as much as I can while I'm, you know, harvesting. So, because you want the greens to keep cool and you want to keep them moist. Well, you know, these are things they don't tell you in the books. You know, most
exactly.
of the time I see people, and while it's quaint and nice not to use plastic, and it'd be great to have some good alternatives to that. You know, you see people with these open baskets, woven baskets, because it's quaint looking. And they're putting greens in the basket in the full open sun.
Wow.
Well, you know, they just wither and, you know, dry and you know, they're by the time you get them into the kitchen, you know, you're just working with limp greens. So, you know, so there are certain tools that you use. Scissors. I use scissors a lot rather than a knife when I'm out in the field because it's so much more efficient. So, you know, things like that are in the book. You know, what kind of tools and what kind of procedure you use to gather these plants so you really come back with great, luscious plants. By the time you get in the kitchen, you know, it looks great still.
I love it. These are the kinds of pearls that you've really developed over years of giving the classes and doing this yourself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's nothing like practical experience to sort of shape you into doing the right thing.
Finding withered greens day in and day out would definitely make you change. Well, I think that this book is going to be wonderful. It's something that's really not available in the wild food world right now.
Oh, this is really going to leapfrog everything else that's out there in terms of what people really need to know in this day and age to get back to nature. Because, you know, we're away from it now. Most people, you know, I don't know how much botany you've had when you've been, you know, going through your elementary school and grade school and early college years.
Not too much.
Yeah, I mean, what botany do they give you? You know, to these days, when you take a botany class, they're teaching about genetic engineering and recombining genes to, you know, make new crops. You know, that's not the botany that I know. The botany that I know has to do with the, you know, real plants and real nature that already exist and learning about those things and then, you know, learning what you can do with them. So, you know, hardly anybody learns about botany anymore, so part of my job in the book is to teach them what they can't get anywhere else.
Oh,
And that's not just about the edibility of it. That's about all the other aspects that you need that lead up to eating the plant. You know, like how to really identify it, how to distinguish it from all the other thousands of plants out there. You know, there are literally hundreds of plants, maybe thousands of plants, that have a basal rosette of leaves like dandelions do.
Really?
And have similar kinds of leaves. You know, I mean, to me, they're all different because I know enough now to really distinguish these plants. But to most people, when they see a basal rosette of leaves, just like, you know, the form that dandelions grow in, you know, it could be hundreds and hundreds of plants to confuse it with. So, again, my goal is to say, okay, you're looking at a particular plant. How do you know it's what you think it is?
Exactly.
How can you really verify that?
I love that. John, we have a caller that I'm going to put on air, and I hope we can all hear each other.
Cool.
Hello, caller.
This would be Mary, Health and Harmony Radio, and you, yes, you are on the air.
Cool.
Finally. Thank you so much, Mary.
13 minutes after the fact, but that's okay.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so glad that we came on. I'm glad we're here now. Welcome. Mary is the founder of the Health and Harmony Radio Network, and so happy to have you on the line.
Well,
hi,
I have... Hi, I have somewhat of an ignorant question for you.
Well, we're all ignorant. I'm so ignorant
and,
I can't tell you.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, too, I mean, I've spent a lot of time, you know, out in farms and all that kind of thing, and the only, you know, wild vegetables I've ever really come across is like asparagus. So are you talking primarily about greens when you're talking about wild, you know, kind of like wild vegetables, or are there other things out there that also grow?
There's every kind of food you can imagine out there, you know, nuts, seeds, asparagus-like vegetables, leafy kind of vegetables, roots, you know, everything you can imagine is out there. The plants I'm focusing on in my first book are mostly greens, and the reason for that, well, actually, the focus is easily accessible, as close as your backyard foods, wild foods, that everybody in North America could find.
Okay.
So if you turn over the soil in your garden, without planting any tomatoes or peas or anything, just turn over the soil and water, what you'll get is at least 50% of those plants are edible plants.
Oh, wow. Well, now I'm in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a lot of rock and tumbleweeds and a couple of cactus here and there. Is there still edible plants here if you kind of go out into those wilder areas?
Yeah, yeah. You know, there, almost every cacti has some food use to it.
Oh, okay.
You know, a lot of these plants are in such harsh environments, they don't have to be very poisonous because, you know, they don't have many predators. And so, yeah, a lot of the desert plants are have edible aspects to them. Now, you may not like what you taste in some of them, and that's because, you know, primitive cultures, early cultures that worked with these things, either processed them to some degree to make them taste good, or since they grew up with them, the flavor, you know, was something that their brain learned to love.
Okay.
But as adults, you try and eat some of these things and, you know, back teaching, so to speak, your brain to like something like that is much more difficult.
So when you pick these greens, I mean, are you cooking them or eating them raw, chopping them up, making a salad, or what do you do with them?
Primarily I eat them raw, but I put them in everything. You know, I'm not a raw foodist. I'm just a normal human, so to speak. And but most of the vegetable matter I eat is raw because I think that's really a healthy way to eat.
You know, John, I'm looking at the copy of Wild Food Primer, which is your great reference book, and it's got a gourmet meal that you too could gather from the wild, and it's got cattail asparagus, tawny day lily flower, wild spinach, wild mustard, chickweed, and tawny day lily buds, and it looks incredible.
That actually sounds very good.
It looks gorgeous.
If you know what you're doing with wild foods, just like if you know how to cook with kale, you know, kale is one of those and collards is even a more extreme example. For most people in North America, they don't know what to do with those greens, and they're a little harsh sometimes, and they're also a little tough.
What in doubt, deuce.
So if you just ate them like lettuce, it doesn't work.
Mm-mm.
So you need to know what to do with them in order to make them more palatable, more you have a better mouth feel, all that kind of stuff. And the same thing is true with a lot of wild foods. Now, there's some like purslane and lamb's quarters and chickweed, which, you know, as long as you gather the right part, are like absolutely delicious and conventional in every way your taste buds would love right now.
Hmm.
But if you tried to eat some curly dock leaves, from an adult plant that are raw, it's not a very pleasant experience.
Well, Well, you'd have to come out here to Las Vegas. We're going to have to go out in the desert somewhere.
I like it. You're going to have a guided tour. That's
I have
actually
a guided tour.
So,
well, thank you so much. This is a wonderful show, and congratulations on your first one.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks so much for calling in. I had a wonderful introduction, but I'm going to do it next show. And again, the Health and Harmony Radio Network is where we're broadcasting from. Thank you, Mary.
You are
Thanks,
so welcome.
Mary.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, John, we have about 8 minutes left. And if anybody's out there want to get some last-minute questions in, the number is 914-338-0821. And we had a couple of questions from the chat room. First of all, when is your book coming out?
Well, I just handed it to the publisher, and for some odd reason, it takes like a year and 3 months. So it's going to be the spring of 2010 when this is out on the market.
Okay, spring of 2010. That's a little – do you know what the name of it is going to be?
Well, originally I was going to call it Wild Gourmet Garden Edibles as
okay.
a euphemism for edible weeds because, you know, weeds, who's going to buy a book about weeds?
About weeds,
you know,
exactly.
Even though that's what they are, you know, marketing is a huge thing and, you know, the title of your book makes a huge difference on, you know, who's going to pick up the book. Now, whether people, you know, buy it called weeds or buy it called, you know, gourmet garden edibles, the outcome will still be the same. They'll have a great experience with the wild foods they discover and try after that.
Okay, very, very exciting. And I guess I wanted to know, when you talk about the weeds and the greens, we touched on this before, but they're actually really important for, I think you started to mention it, they're really important for the soil itself. They're actually an integral part of creating healthy soil.
Well, as long as they're growing and dying in the same place, you know, if you're not harvesting weeds
mm-hmm.
from the same place all the time, what happens is because weeds, you know, a lot of them typically have much deeper roots than grasses and other things. They go way deep in the soil, pull up lots of micronutrients, minerals, things like that, bring them to the surface. When the plant dies, all those minerals then are at the surface of the soil. But if you keep harvesting from that area, you're going to deplete the soil. And so you have to put things back, you know, put poop back on the soil or, you know, whatever you use to fertilize your land. Like I'm always putting compost back onto my soil because if I didn't, it would be depleted.
Okay, because you are picking the wild greens out of there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I take a lot of nutrients out of the soil, from those plants. So I got to put stuff back or, you know, after a while, even the weeds will be suffering.
Exactly. And we do have a question about, do you have any, you want to name the current published books that you have?
Well, there's like 300. Where do you want me to start? Well,
question from the chat room, but I know you have, if people go to wildfoodadventures.com, you have an incredible compendium of all of the newsletters that you've published over the years.
Yeah, the newsletters are available in a box set or individual ones, but if you want some current books, there is a book review section at my website, and I only review in there the best books.
Okay.
And those are the only ones that are there. If I reviewed a book and it was an average or even a better than average book, I didn't even put it in there because I only wanted the best book. So if you go there, that's the best way to find some good resources on wild foods.
Excellent, excellent. We got a thank you from the chat room as well. Now for dessert, since we ate our greens, I saw the most incredible video that Sunny Savage from wildfoodplants.com did when she was in town, and I cannot believe what you cooked up there on the video. And the video is available at foodawakenings.com. Will you tell us a little bit about what you did that day?
Yeah, sure. Just before that, let me say that even though the book I'm writing is about greens, it's about greens and all the other things they produce. So some of them have edible roots, some of them have edible flowers, some have edible asparagus kind of properties. So it's not just greens, but other kinds of vegetables will be covered if that green has those other attributes. But
Beautiful. Yay.
The marshmallows, yeah. You know, the original marshmallow was made from the marshmallow plant. You know, there's the common mallow and the marshmallow. And the marshmallow is a plant that usually grows in salt marshes. But people plant it all over now because it's quite a medicinal plant. And about 200 years ago, there was actually sort of a gooey confection made out of the roots that was the original marshmallow. That was something that was made in France. And about 175 years ago, the Kraft Corporation stopped using real marshmallow root in their recipe, and it's mostly made of cornstarch now. That's what the Jet Puff marshmallows are in the store.
So we have 3 minutes remaining. So, this is amazing. This video and what you're talking about, how they've taken the marshmallow, and I'm just going to kind of, shorten it a little bit. What
Sure.
you did was you actually took the mallow or the malva, which is a green in and of itself, and got the mucilaginous part, whipped it up, and essentially made marshmallow. Right.
Yes, I did. I invented that recipe. Well, so I took the fruits to do of the common mallow, which is a common weed, what they did years ago out of the roots of the marshmallow.
It was amazing, and I hope people will take an opportunity to go look at that video. They made marshmallow s'mores out of the green mallow, and that was really something ingenious that you came up with, John. John, I want to thank you so much. We had a little technical glitch, but I think we got through it pretty well. Still got the show on, and your information, I could tell from the chat room, was really appreciated. So thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
And people can reach you at wildfoodadventures.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
And they will be looking for your book. I'm getting a lot of thank yous and a lot of people who are interested from the chat room. So, John, thanks again.
Thank you, and good luck on your show.
Thank you so much. And I want to let everybody know that next week we'll go through what the show is about a little bit more. We'll have really, I think, a different experience, so I hope you'll tune in. But I want to let you know that we are doing the most amazing discussion of seawater and how seawater is being used to remineralize our soil. Because mineral deficiencies are incredibly rampant, and I would really call them pandemic in our world. And so it is so important to talk about how we can put minerals back into the soil and then minerals from the plants back into us. There's so many effects on the human body of mineral deficiency, from high blood pressure to joint and muscle pain, insomnia, attention deficit disorder, and it just goes on and on. So we will be talking to a great extent with John Hartman of Ocean Grown, who is harvesting seawater in a very safe and non-toxic way, and we're going to talk extensively about the use of the seawater in soil and how it's changing fruits and vegetables and how important this is for human nutrition. So that's it for today. I want to tell you to tune in next week at 4 o'clock Pacific time, and also you can tune in at any time on the archives, and I encourage you to listen to any of the shows on the Health and Harmony Network, including Sweet Remedy Radio, Health and Harmony, the wonderful Julian Michael with his hilarious show about numerology, an informative show about numerology, Soul Magic. And we're going to end it here. I hope you have a wonderful week. Be well. Thank you.
quality auto parts for your vehicle? Shop one of the 48 Portland O'Reilly Auto Parts stores. You'll find we have convenient locations, thousands of brand name products in stock, extended store hours, everyday low prices, and well-trained professional parts people. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day.
Oh, O'Reilly.